good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. My guest, Stephen White, says if you want to make America the best it can be this election year, become the best Catholic you can be. Stephen is a fellow in the Catholic Studies program at the Ethics and Public Policy Center. His work focuses on the application of Catholic social teaching to a broad spectrum of contemporary political and cultural issues. His writings appeared in many media outlets, including National Review Online, Huffington Post, America Magazine. He's written at CatholicVote.org. And since 2005, he's coordinated an annual seminar in Catholic social thought in Krakow, Poland. He has recently published Red, White, Blue, and Catholic. And it's a good short, roughly 100-page book, taking a look at the issues of being a faithful disciple in this political order. Stephen, good to have you with me.
A real pleasure to be here, Al.
Well, let's, this being an election year, I think there's a lot more attention being paid to what it means to be a faithful citizen, a faithful disciple in this social order. What's the first thing Catholics need to keep in mind in a bitterly divided political year?
Well, in a year like this, one of the important things is to not let the rancor of our politics infect our personal lives and our relationships with one another. Politics is important. That's one of the things I talk about in the book. It is important, but we have to keep it in its proper place. It's not worth having our families divided and our friendships broken up over the likes of Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton.
Yeah.
So keeping politics in its proper place is really important.
I think that's right. I mean, something we have this kind of approach avoidance problem with politics. We want it to do too much, then we don't think it can do anything. We're always swinging back and forth between what we can expect out of it. So I think your advice is good, which is, look, don't let these polarizations, don't let these ideologically tinted arguments divide you from those you love and from other members of the body of Christ. What analytical tools should we bring in our analysis of these candidates?
That's a really good question, Al. You know, being informed is an easy thing to say and sometimes a harder thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
It means putting in some research and looking at not only what policies do various politicians, and it's not just about the people at the top of the ticket, of course.
Right.
You know, what not only what positions do they say they support, but what do their records show? Do they have a history of keeping their word? Are they flip-flopping around all the time?
Mm-hmm.
Being informed is hard, and one of the things I talk about in the book is particularly these days, it's hard to find sources of information that don't seem to be really skewed one way or another.
Right.
One of the ways to get around this is to as far as time allows, look to different kinds of media. Right. Don't just stick with one cable news channel. Listen to this radio show, but also listen
sure.
to lots of other radio shows.
Absolutely.
One of the places I like to look at every day, and not to plug a site that I have no affiliation with, but Real Clear Politics generally does a good job of giving a broad overview of political commentary for
mm-hmm.
the day. And they'll usually balance one point of view with another.
Mm-hmm.
So finding sources of information that are reliable so that you can stay informed is really important. And knowing not just who's at the top of the ticket, but like I said, especially in a year like this,
mm-hmm.
pay attention to local races, local politics, state politics. Those things, if anything, matter more in a year like this than they do normally.
Let me bring up some objections that people I've heard people say, both within the Catholic Church, but often outside the Church as well, among other non-Catholic Christians. We shouldn't be involved in politics. It's of the world. It distracts us from our duties to be a faithful Christian.
Yeah, well, there's a certain amount of truth in that. It can distract us from being a faithful Christian.
Right.
The trick is to engage politics in a way that doesn't distract us from our true goal, but brings our faith and the great gift that we have as bearers of this, as witnesses to the truth of the faith, that brings that to bear in this world that we find ourselves in. We're called to love the world that we live in, not the world as we wish it would be or as that we could imagine it might be. And that means loving a fallen world with all its temptations, all its shortcomings, all of our shortcomings. One of the things that really is distinctive about how Christians, and Catholics in particular, what we bring to politics is that we have this view of politics as something that's really important, but it's something that's not the ultimate horizon of human activity or human experience. We know that there's something more important and beyond politics. Our broader horizon relativizes politics. It keeps it in its place. It reminds us that the state is not the ultimate end of human life, that Caesar is not God, to paraphrase our Lord. Mm-hmm. But it also, so it puts politics at a lower level. It keeps us in its proper place. But it doesn't absolve us from, or get us off the hook from, engaging politics seriously. If anything, Christians can remind, ought to know, and we should remind one another, but we can also be a witness to those around us, that things of this world, including politics, matter. They matter tremendously. What we do in this world echoes for eternity. Mm-hmm. And the choices that we make, the moral choices we make, not just only in our private lives, but in how we organize our lives together, how we work to serve the common good, how we work to serve others, to build up our communities, those things matter precisely because of our conviction that what we do in this life helps shape us and matters for eternity. So that Christian perspective, relativizing politics, but also making sure that it remains important and we don't sort of devolve into nihilism or, oh, who cares, it's all going to end up badly anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that Christians can really witness to, especially when politics gets tough.
There's a problem I've heard oftentimes in mainline Protestant circles, this goes back about 20 years, where people talk a lot about we're bringing in the kingdom through political activism. That's not very effective, or not very accurate language, is it?
Yeah, well, it depends on what one means by that. It is true that the kingdom of God starts now, right? And
right.
That what we do as Christians is involved in that.
That's
the
right.
City of God. This is St. Augustine was talking about this 1,600 years ago. But there is a real danger in using Christianity as a political tool because it puts the church and the work of discipleship in service of political ends.
Right.
And it confuses worldly ends with heavenly ends. And it's tricky. We've already talked about how our faith informs our politics, and that politics is important precisely because of our faith and because we're Christians. But we have to understand that that politics per se is not the proper or appropriate or adequate arena for our faith as a whole.
Mm-hmm.
That is, our faith, when it's lived well, will have political implications. But it's not a political thing as such.
Right.
And we have to be careful not to use the faith as a political instrument. It's a very dangerous thing, and it's a great temptation.
And it's happened, right, throughout American history. This happens.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Can a Christian vote for an atheist?
Can a Christian vote for an atheist?
Yeah.
Well, hypotheticals are always tough. I would say yes. I mean,
sure.
It depends on what you mean. I mean, if there's someone possessed of natural virtues, mm-hmm. and who is wise and not particularly vicious and responsible and seems to do as best as he can to serve the common good, he or she can to serve the common good, and given the right political circumstances, I could see voting for that,
mm-hmm.
that person. It's tricky to pick one thing that this person does or doesn't believe and try and vote based on that.
That's the key to this person's
competence. Yeah, and I don't want to make the right. I don't want to make the argument, and we should make the argument that there are certain issues that are more important that carry more weight than others. There's not a moral equivalence between how one wants to adjust the Medicare growth rate and whether or not one supports legal abortion, for example.
Right.
Those aren't, we're not talking about the same things. It's apples and oranges. But it's also very tempting to try and pick one issue or two issues and just use those to try and shut down debate about the viability of certain candidates or about the viability of certain
mm-hmm.
positions.
Yeah.
And it's one thing to draw clear lines that must be drawn.
Yeah.
It's another thing to constantly be looking for sort of the silver bullet that will end the debate once and for all so that we can move on and have our way.
Yeah.
We have to be willing to talk about things with people we disagree with. It's hard, but it's part of politics. It's part of human life.
Yeah, I've often said over this last generation, abortion has made us dumb. because it's the morally defining issue of this generation, it seems to me. It is one of those political issues upon which we have great moral clarity. And oftentimes, once having established that a particular candidate is pro-life, the other candidate is pro-choice, pro-abortion, we stop thinking. I mean, in a sense, oh, my decision is made now. So there's no pursuit of what other issues need to be discussed. They may not change your ultimate vote, but, you know, you do want to know something about the environment. You do want to know something about reduction of poverty. You do want to know something about what we can do politically to end human trafficking. So there is a sense, it seems to me, that the reliance upon abortion as our primary issue it gives us moral clarity, but it also often keeps us from getting into further conversation about these other issues.
Yeah, it can become a sort of trump card that one plays that sort of is supposed to be the end of the conversation. And in a sense, it's understandable why that issue plays that role in our politics, because it is such a grave evil. It is like the scale of is just appalling.
And it may end the conversation when you enter the ballot box, but it shouldn't end the conversation when you're at the dinner table.
Right, right. No, I completely agree with you on this. One of the things that Pope Francis says a lot in Laudato Si, in his encyclical, is everything is connected. He's talking mostly about environmental issues and how we interact with creation, with the gift of creation. But there's really something to that. Again, not to draw on moral equivalence, but if we treat the things of this world as just so much stuff and disposable, the culture of waste that he's always talking about. Then we're inviting into our lives what Pope Benedict XVI called the dictatorship of relativism, where stuff doesn't have meaning other than what we give to it, right? And in a sense, that same phenomenon was what John Paul II described as the culture of death. And these things really are interrelated. They're not just standalone issues.
Right.
It's not moral equivalence between all issues, but they are related. And it's really important to not forget that, just because we have to fight a particular fight at a particular time.
Very good. My guest, Stephen White, is the author of an outstanding little book, Red, White, Blue, and Catholic. We're going to come back on the other side of the break and talk about these four or so fundamental principles of Catholic social teaching.
Wine, culture, and spirituality. Take a one-day pilgrimage on Saturday, August 13th, to the Thumb of Michigan with Monsignor Robert McClory and Father Jeffrey Day. Experience a winery tour and tasting. Explore Michigan's oldest lighthouse and savor a catered lunch at the Port Huron Museum. Enjoy wine pairings with food as you hear about the theological connections between wine and soul. Feed your soul and satisfy your senses as you soak in the beauty of our great state. Call Corporate Travel 800-727-1999.
A lot of people think that street evangelization involves yelling out of a bullhorn telling people that they're going to hell. Not so with St. Paul's Street Evangelization. Our methods are non-confrontational and effective. We simply offer information on the Catholic faith, along with rosaries, miraculous medals, and prayer. Pope Francis wrote about how beautiful it is to see street preachers joyfully bringing Jesus to every corner of the earth. Street evangelization is fun and fruitful. Join us today at streetevangelization.com.
It's time for Family Man with Dr. Gregory Popchak.
One of the signs of strong commitment between a husband and a wife is that they have a strong identity as a couple. Having a strong couple identity means there's a me, a you, and an us, like the Trinity. All three identities matter, and all are honored in how we go through life together. Unfortunately, new research by sociologist Dr. Paul Amato argues that couples are fast becoming married singles. Millennial couples are substantially less likely than couples in 1980 to eat together, visit friends together, go out for leisure activities together, or work on projects around the house together. They were less likely to participate in clubs or groups together as well. Home alone becomes alone together. Catholic couples can stand against this tide. Make time for your marriage when you plan your week. Remember that the most important activity is family life. I'm Dr. Greg Popchak, but you can call me Family Man.
To discover more ways faith can enrich your life, visit CatholicCounselors.com.
May God's grace shine on you. This is Lewis Brown, director of CMF Curo, the Catholic Healthcare Sharing Ministry. CMF Curo is an affordable, beautiful, Christ-centered healthcare alternative for you and your family. It protects you, your religious liberty, and the gospel of life. With open enrollment upon us, now is the time to take action. Explore and join CMF Curo today. Go to cmfcuro.com. That is CMFCURO.com. And may his light be brilliant in you.
Hi, everybody. Dr. Ray here. Living Right with Dr. Ray, the TV show, is coming up to the Ann Arbor area on the road. August 22nd and 23rd. Two shows, 4 and 6:30 each day. Get to meet Al Cresta. Teresa Tomeo, we'd love to have you in the audience. You can bring the kids. Go to AveMariaRadio.net. Get your tickets. Limited seats are available. Those of you with the obnoxious children, we may sit you in the back.
This is Lavinia Spirito for Catholic Way Bible Study. In Luke 5, Jesus invites Peter, weary from a night of fruitless fishing, back out onto the Sea of Galilee to cast his nets one more time and trust Jesus for the results. To cast into the deep is to let go of our own opinions, desires, and the way things or people should be. To cast into the deep, even where we have already fished with no results, is to let go of independence, autonomy, and self-determination. The sooner we realize that our Beloved is holding us in His hands, the sooner we can get about the business of doing our Father's will. The sooner we will become disciples. Proverbs sums up this great secret lesson learned by the saints. Trust in the Lord with all your heart and lean not on your own understanding. In all your ways, submit to Him and He will make your path straight. Let go and trust the Lord to direct your activities and your life. He knows what He's doing.
Catholic Way Bible Study. Peace, power, purpose. Find out more at cwbs.org.
Good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. With me, Stephen White. He is a fellow in the Catholic Studies program at the Ethics and Public Policy Center, where he focuses on applying Catholic social teaching to a wide variety of contemporary political and cultural issues. He's given us an outstanding little book called Red, White, Blue, and Catholic, and we're taking a look at what it means to be a faithful disciple of Jesus in the American social order here. What are the fundamental principles of Catholic social teaching? I think you list four of them.
Yeah, well, the Church, in the compendium of the Catholic Social Doctrine of the Church, they call them the four permanent principles of Catholic social teaching. They're not the only parts, but you can think of it as sort of the framework or the skeleton that all the sort of all the flesh and sinew is built upon.
Okay.
And they are the dignity of the human person, solidarity and subsidiarity, and the common good. And they all work together. I think one of the things, one of the reasons I talked about why I start the book by talking about this is that we often see Catholic social teaching as sort of a bundle of different sort of exhortations and prohibitions, do this, don't do this, and sort of a policy platform cobbled together. But it's much more than that. It's really a coherent vision of the human person and what it means to be a social being and to be made for community. And these principles help to sort of sketch that out, how the Church understands us and our place within society, including political society.
Okay. Well, let's go through them, get a kind of a thumbnail definition of them. When we talk about the dignity of the human person, we are referring to what?
Well, what you hear a lot on this, the answers to this question, you hear a lot from Catholics and Christians, that we're made in the image and likeness of God, which of course is true. But the dignity of the human person is more than that. We're not just, it doesn't just refer to our origins, right, being created by God and in His image, but it also it suggests our end, because we're made for communion, for community, ultimately for communion in God, with God in heaven, and so it has to do with our origins, but also our ends, and that points to what I list as the last, but is in a sense the highest and most important of the four principles, which is the common good, that. Because of the kind of persons we are, because of the kind of things we were made to be, our good, what is good for us, our flourishing, is fully realized in the context of other people, other persons. And the common good is the good of all of the members of society, of all of the parts of society, the families, the schools, the churches, the parish, all the rest, and also the good of the whole itself. So it's all of those goods taken together. It's not simply a collectivism. It's not just the sum of its parts. It's more than the sum of its parts. So what we do in society has to aim for the good of the whole, because by being citizens of this country, our the political common good accounts for the good of all of us, but also for the good of the whole. We're more than the sum of our parts.
And then the principles of subsidiarity and solidarity serve that process in what way?
Yeah, well, they sort of flesh out that the space between. One of the things I talk about a lot is the need for civil society. A lot of our politics focuses on the rights of the individual, or focuses on what government can do. And there's this huge space in between that we often miss. And that space, civil society, are where we spend most of our lives, where most of the work of our citizenship gets done. That space is really described pretty well by the principles of solidarity and subsidiarity. Solidarity is it's described a couple ways in Catholic social teaching, but it's a principle of mutual responsibility. I'm responsible for myself, for my children, for my family, but I'm also responsible for my neighbors and in some way for the entire community around me.
Mm-hmm.
The sense of responsibility of all for all. And it's a virtue, acting on that responsibility.
So this deals with social cooperation.
Absolutely, absolutely. And the principle that goes with it is subsidiarity. And subsidiarity is often taken to be sort of a counterbalance to solidarity, right?
Mm-hmm.
So solidarity is sort of a collectivist principle, and subsidiarity is often seen as sort of a decentralizing principle. And that's not really a good way to think about it.
Okay.
Subsidiarity is about putting authority in society at the proper level, which often means a lower level than what the state would like. The state likes to do lots of things, and sometimes it likes to do things that it shouldn't do. Mm-hmm. Subsidiarity cuts against that. But what subsidiarity is really about is making sure that things are being done at the proper level, right? I have authority over my children because I'm their father.
Mm-hmm.
Not because it's efficient, not because it's just the lowest possible level, because that's the kind of relationship I have, right? And the pastor has the responsibility for his parish because of the kind of relationship that is. So subsidiarity really deals with kinds of relationships. And there's this beautiful network and intricacy in our social life that the principle of subsidiarity guards and protects.
Mm-hmm.
And what's interesting about these two principles, solidarity and subsidiarity, is that they're mutually reinforcing. If you think about the places where we learn solidarity, responsibility for one another and all the rest, usually the place we learn that is in the lower levels of society, first in our families, in our schools, in our parishes, among friends and in our local neighborhoods. This is where we learn how to be responsible. At the same time, those little communities, our families, our parishes, all the rest of it, those things can't flourish if there's not a sense of solidarity within the society at large and within those places, and a sense of solidarity that protects the lower levels of society. Religious freedom becomes very important in this sense, because religious freedom, in a sense, protects out of solidarity the proper role of the church in society, which we can talk about, but that's a really important, crucial part of civil society, and it's right at the heart of the interplay between solidarity and subsidiarity.
In fact, let's talk about the role of the church. Generally, the state frequently when people discuss these matters, they look upon the state as divinely established in some way to achieve certain purposes related to justice and the protection of the innocent. And the church is looked at as a differently established institution by God for the purpose of it's the pilot plant of the new humanity. It's where people become discipled into the image of Christ. And so these are two different institutions. What does one have to do with the other?
Well, this is a tricky question, and it's a question that Christians have been trying to provide better or worse answers to for a very long time. This is a question that Christ himself was asked.
Sure. Right?
This is the render under Caesar question.
Right.
Was a version of this question. One of the things that I think is a challenge today is that we often think of society as belonging to the state or belonging to government, and that government sort of deputizes other institutions to do certain aspects of social work for them, right?
Right.
And so that's problematic for any number of reasons,
yes.
Not least of which because it treats social action as essentially the action of the state that the state somehow sort of allows other people to take over. So you look at the Little Sisters of the Poor, who take care of the elderly, the sick, and the dying. They're not doing the state's work for the work so long as the state allows them to do that.
Right.
They're doing the work that they need to do. And the state ought to protect them and help them to flourish in their work. When the state claims a monopoly on all social spaces and on all social and common and public goods, it creates a real problem. So the state can't sort of claim it's a total authority over society.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, we shouldn't just talk about what the church brings to society in terms of utility, right? So the church does all kinds of amazing work and provides all kinds of incredible social goods, from Catholic schools to, like I said, you know, Little Sisters of the Poor, all kinds of social justice work, all kinds of pro-life work. The church does tons of that, and that's to the benefit of all society. But perhaps the most important thing that the church does is, we've already hinted at it, the church reminds citizens, and the state too, that the state's not God.
Right.
It reminds us that the horizon of our experiences, the goal, our end, is beyond the realm of politics. And this, the church reminds us of that and prepares us to live in that way. That's not something the state can do. In fact, that's not something that any group other than the church can do.
Yeah.
And that's before we get into the supernatural role of the church, the properly supernatural role of the church, providing the sacraments,
mm-hmm.
providing the, you know, being the conduit for the grace that enables us to live as sons and daughters of God. So the church provides an irreplaceable aspect of the human good. And when we talk about religious freedom, we have to be careful to insist that religious freedom is not just about being left alone. it's about insisting that what the church has to offer is something that's good, it's something that's important, it's something that society needs, and that when that is sidelined, when the church is sidelined, when the proper work of the church is sidelined, the church suffers, but mostly the common good suffers.
Right.
Society suffers,
exactly.
Because society is being deprived of the one thing that the church alone can provide, which is God, grace.
Yes.
And when the church, when that's pushed aside, the common good suffers far more than the church does.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so we have to have that positive account of, we have to be, the church needs to be free to do good things, not just left alone to do, you know, whatever it is Catholics do when they're being left alone.
Now, this comes out in this, often these misunderstandings come up during debates about tax exemption, as though somehow the church is tax exempt because the state decided somewhere along the line that as long as the church does some of the work of the state, it won't tax the church. And rather than seeing the church's liberty from tax exemption as related to its fundamental nature, as distinct from the state. And I think this might be a good area to explore, is why in our polity do we have tax exemption for churches?
Yeah, you need a lawyer and a legal historian to flesh that out, because the history is sort of complicated. A lot of the way that we treat tax exemption and stuff developed sort of more or less organically over a long period of centuries, really.
Right.
But underlying it, to sidestep the history, if you will, underlying it is this idea that common goods, small c, small g, common goods, goods that serve a portion of, or even the whole of society, don't belong to the state.
Right.
The state has a particular responsibility for the whole, a unique responsibility for the whole, but it's not the sole purveyor of goods that serve the whole, of goods that serve society.
Yeah.
And when it acts as though it is, it creates a great problem. So whether that manifests itself in tax law, it ought to manifest itself in tax law. The particulars of how that happens and how that came about historically, those details are not my expertise.
Yeah.
But the underlying point is that we don't need permission to serve the common good, right? And neither does the church.
I'll tell you, Stephen, great talking with you. We're out of time today, but I hope I can call on you again in the future. I'd like to have continued discussion with you on this.
Oh, I'd love to.
All right. We'll do so. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Stephen White is the author of an outstanding book called Red, White, Blue, and Catholic. We'll have it available, of course, in our online store at AveMariaRadio.net.